hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fight beside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down the key. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you run down my country, man, you walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you are walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on White Resistance Radio. Lots more news and news for our people, and of course those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, lots more news and views for us, and hardly know where to begin this chilly, my gosh, this is a chilly, snowy, sleety winter, well, late evening here just outside of Toronto, Ontario, actually in the neighboring city of Hamilton, which is my new residence. And one of the fascinating things about that is that this is the third winter storm that we've endured in this area thus far this year. And one of the things that kind of fascinates me about that is that wasn't there something called global warming? Wasn't that something that is supposed to be going on here? Well, I don't know. I don't see much about the warning. Good friend of mine from who's a former political prisoner, Brad Love, gave me a call today, and he said, "Did you see hear the latest?" I said, "Well, I don't know. What's the latest?" He said, "Well, we're bringing in 100 slaves from Niger." That's N-I-G-E-R. Yeah, I know. We've got to be careful how we say it, don't we? Oh yeah. Ooh. Might be some hurt feelings somewhere. 100 slaves from Niger. I said, "Well, what for?" "Oh, I don't know," he said. Our Somali immigration minister is on a new kick. So here's the story according to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Hundreds of former slaves headed to Canada were exploited and abused in, let me just deal with this for a moment, were exploited and abused in Libya. And where they're coming our way. And to get to be more precise, according to our immigration minister, the Muslim Somali immigration lawyer and former head of the Canadian Somali Association. Yeah, he's the guy who stands on guard for us, Ahmed Hassan. Anyway, hundreds of refugees coming to Canada were lured from their home countries by criminals detained in horrible conditions in Libya and sold into slavery, says Leonard Doyle, director of the UN's International Office for Migration. More than 150 people from Libyan detention centers have been resettled in Canada, and another 600 people rescued from slavery in Libya are expected over the next 2 years, Immigration Minister Ahmed Hassan said today. Well, it's yesterday. No. Canada is also planning to take in 100 refugees from Niger who were rescued from Libyan migrant detention centers. Ooh. Doyle spoke to As It Happens, host Carol Off about what happens to some of the people who risk everything to travel to Libya with the dream of crossing the Mediterranean into Europe, illegally, of course. Here's part of the conversation. First of all, she asks, how do these people come to be auctioned off at slave markets? We don't know for sure, but one thing that's clear, though, is that many of the people were lured from their homes in West Africa and elsewhere. Some were forced because they were fleeing violence, of course. Some were asylum seekers in that sense. Others were economic migrants trying to better their lives. I'm still not seeing how they were forced. And along the journey, many of them were terribly abused, trafficked, put into servitude, treated badly. But we also know they use social media to get on the journey. Okay, so that, I mean, they're relatively hip, modern Africans. Every one of them on a cell phone. And Carol Ott asks, what do you mean? Or Off asks, what do you mean they use social media? This is how they were lured from their homes? Question. I mean, not everyone by any means, but certainly these people, the people who were organizing them, the so-called connection men that they met in the villages and towns who are part of this long criminal chain, they're using WhatsApp and other encrypted services like Messenger to shepherd their charges through the, you know, very inhospitable terrain. What countries have they come from, is the question. They're from all over. They're from, you know, at least the 14 countries of West Africa, also from Eritrea, that's on the east part of the continent, in particular from Ethiopia, East Africa, even from as far as Bangladesh and beyond. Because Libya became basically a kind of open wound in the southern flank of Europe that people realized that they could get through, but not really knowing that there were these dreadfully exploitative people there who would take advantage of them, traffic them, make them modern-day slaves, as it's often called, but also put them literally on the slave block. A bit of a sidebar here. Libya only became this after the West, and that's primarily Canada, the United States, Britain, France, and Italy, engineered the overthrow of longtime Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. And Gaddafi was an unusual person, and he had some unusual ideas. He did not want to go along with the Western banking system, which may be what sealed his fate. He had renounced terrorism. He had an extremely progressive social program. Couples, upon being married, were given a house. You know, progressive pro-family behavior. Anyway, the New World Order people thoroughly detested him. And they assisted through bombing the rebels who tried to overthrow him in 2011. That assistance proved crucial militarily, and indeed Gaddafi was eventually overthrown and murdered, murdered like a dog in a ditch by the side of the road. You know, so well, anyway, were democratic days upon us in Libya? Well, no. Libya fell apart, and it continues to fall apart. There are two big factions that are quarreling in the country. Large areas of the country are basically without government. One area has fallen under the influence of Al-Qaeda and has spawned an offshoot. Aqim Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. Another faction area is under the influence of ISIS. Huge quantities of arms have fallen into their hands, and that's largely what's fueling the insurgency and problems farther south in sub-Saharan Africa and places like Niger and Chad and so on. And Gaddafi had warned. See, Gaddafi did not allow hordes of black Africans to surge through his territory and board boats and fly in Europe. And he warned. All that stands between you, that's Europe, and Africa is me. So what did we do? Or what did the New World Order people do? They got rid of him. And what happened? Well, for nearly a decade, there has been an ongoing invasion across the Mediterranean. Now, there's a lot of boo-hoo-hooing here, and you know, I think we should. You want to read these statements with your antennae up. How does a person from, let's say, Niger or Ethiopia? How does he expect to get to Europe? So he travels with, which is, we're told, human traffickers. Well, it's a two-way street here. The traffickers are paid. These illegals, and they are illegal, they want to surge into Europe. They don't go, for instance, to the embassy of, let's say, France or Italy or Austria or Germany and say, listen, here's who I am, here are my credentials, my identification, and I would like to come to your country as a refugee. No, they don't. They're illegals. So that's kind of important. Well, how are you going to get from where you are to the Mediterranean coast and then beyond that to Europe? Just going to walk and then you plunge into the Mediterranean and start swimming? Well, no, again, not likely. What you do is you pay and you contract the services of a people smuggler. Well, that's right. We've got to be, I think, a little realistic here before succumbing to the completely to the boo-hoo-hooing. What's going on here is a contract. An illegal agreement among people to do something that's illegal. These are invaders of Europe. Okay, I'm prepared to believe that sometimes they get conned. That perhaps the so-called people smuggler betrays them. That may well happen. But these are not completely innocent people. But anyway, back to the dialogue between the CBC reporter Carol Off and Leonard Doyle. He's the director of the UN International Office for Migration. He goes on to say, Libya's a very big country, physically very huge. It's bigger than France. But the population is tiny. It's about 5 million. So there's lots of need for laborers, for construction, for cleaning staff, you name it. So a lot of these migrants were shaken down by the people as soon as they crossed the border. They then put them into terrible detention centers, got them to call home, had more money sent through and then sold them off. Okay. Migrants are, there's a picture there, migrants are kept behind bars at a detention camp in Geryon, Libya. Well, yeah, they're illegally in the country. is this odd? Then the question from the interviewer, but the ones who are now part of this resettlement program are those who have survived that and found themselves to be living in some kind of detention conditions. What have you seen? He says, I've traveled twice to Libya and seen the detention centers, and they're frankly appalling. And, of course, I was with a delegation, so we're seeing the cleaned up version. But what was particularly shocking was seeing thousands of people sitting down cross-legged with like a piece of bread in their hands to keep them quiet and really just calling out for help as we came by. And of course, we know that when the doors close and the international eyes are gone, the abuse that is happening there is just off the scales. Well, the people are illegally in the country. Question, most of the people who are in these camps or in these detention centers from which this program comes from, are they mostly singles? Are they families or are they single men? Answer, there's a lot of single men and single women coming through. Not so many families, but indeed, you do see unaccompanied minors, and indeed, they are terribly exploited because there's nobody there to protect them.
Whose fault is that? You know, again, before the boo-hoo-hooing gets going too far, who did this? Who sends unaccompanied minors across hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles of desert and bad territory into a dicey country like Libya? Who does that? This is crazy.
Now, there's a picture there. And yes, these are some of the illegals, black as the ace of spades, sitting on what looks like a blue rug. They all seem fairly well dressed, have hats, they look relatively robust. Let me go further into the article. Question, and if they're coming as individuals, as men, as women, as girls, or as unaccompanied minors, what needs will they have in Canada? Let's listen. What special needs would they have to settle when they don't have their families with them? Answer, people are a long way from home. They're not used to the country, the culture, the climate, if I may say. They obviously need to be integrated into their own community. I'm sure one of the first things that the authorities will do is seek out other people who speak the same language. Well, that's French in many cases. Have the same religion, that kind of thing. Well, that's Islam in many cases. Oh, no. It's super important for future generations that migrants and refugees who come are integrated well, that they feel fully part of the new community. I think the problems we have seen recently in Europe come from poor integration of the people. People feeling marginalized. Such a absolute crock from this UN official. People feel marginalized. Now, what is that? They chose to invade Europe. They were never invited. They feel marginalized because they're radically different. Well, let me give you my take on this. So it looks as though we're going to get about 600 of these people in the next few years. Many of them, or some of them, former, in quotation marks, slaves. Most of them, single men, in some cases, single women. What's going to happen? Well, let me tell you what's going to happen. What are we getting? Well, we're getting people who tried illegally to enter Europe and ran into trouble. That we can be sure of. Gee, are these going to make good new Canadians? Well, I don't think so. If indeed they've been traumatized. Now, the UN official, Mr. Duffy? Mr. Doyle, I think, lays it on a bit thick.
Yeah, they've been detained. They may have been compelled to work to pay off the people smugglers, or the what are sometimes called the traffickers. If indeed they've been traumatized, do we need traumatized people here? What huge skills do they bring that we are just dying to have? Well, it's not very obvious what skills they bring. If they were more skilled, might they have not gone a different route to Europe? So we are getting unqualified people who may or may not have been through some suffering. If they've been through some suffering, they may be bringing mental illnesses, etc., with them. Boy, we're getting a bargoon, aren't we? This is beyond insane. If there's a desire on the part of some people to help these people, surely the more efficient economic way to help them is to set up a fund for them and to assist them to return to their home countries, perhaps with a little bit of money in their pocket. Now, I'm not even saying the Canadian government should do that. I frankly don't think it's our business. But say on an individual basis, individual Canadians or charities wish to do that. That might be a more effective way. For a few tens of dollars, these people could be set up for several months in their home countries. A few tens of dollars won't even begin to cover the cost of bringing these people to Canada, putting them on welfare, Medicare, all the goodies. We're going to have to find them housing. And then, of course, as the questioner alluded, they're going to have to be integrated. Well, that's going to cost more. There are going to be special programs and to try to, in some cases, bring them up to snuff in terms of language. It'll be just one endless expense. Now, I'm not one who closely follows the fashion scene, but I noticed an item the other day in the National Post, a headline, Gucci's blackface sweater pulled after outrage. Oh, jeez. There is an absolute insanity afoot about this blackface thing that blew up a few weeks ago with the left-wing Democratic governor of Virginia, who when there were several pictures from his 1985 medical school yearbook of a man in blackface, that's a white person with black foot painted on their face, as was done in the old minstrel shows, and another one in the Ku Klux Klan robe. Now, at first, it was said that one of these was Governor Burtham, I think his name is. First of all, he apologized for it. Then he said, well, actually, it wasn't him. It couldn't be both, obviously. They're two different characters. But the whole idea of blackface, the insult of it all, how racist it is, it's practically lynching the poor Negroes. Well, of course, it's nothing of the sort. Blackface was actually a backhanded compliment to blacks. Blackface was done in something that were called minstrel shows that were very popular in the latter years of the 19th century and the first two or three decades of the 20th century as a form of entertainment, where there would be these Negro characters, sometimes comical, would sing songs that often celebrated the days on the old plantation. And some of these characters were comical, and of course the complaint is, well, they were stereotypes, that these people were rather happy-go-lucky, shiftless,
not necessarily prone to too much work, and sometimes they were prone to thieving. Well, as with any generalization, the generalization doesn't fit every individual. Like the stingy or fairly shrewd about his penny Scotsman. I'm sure there are some Scotsmen who are spendthrifts, and so on and so on. But anyway, the outrage was huge. And what's happened to poor Gucci here? Rome. Gucci has apologized after complaints that a wool sweater with an oversized collar designed to cover the bottom of the face resembled blackface makeup, and said the item had been pulled from the online and physical stores. It was the latest case of a fashion house having to apologize for cultural or racial insensitivity, and further evidence that Italy, in particular, has a wretched record with racial insensitivity staining everything from fashion to soccer and politics. In other words, Italy is just perhaps not as politically correct as other parts of Europe. The turtleneck block wool balaclava sweater, which sells for US $890. I don't think any of you are going to be running out to buy one before. Oh well, you'd be taken off the shelves anyway. Okay. Covers the nose and includes a red cutout for the mouth. It was ridiculed on social media as insensitive and racist at a time when the US is grappling with cases of old photos of politicians with their faces blackened. The polo neck was described as a racist gollywog image, with one Twitter user remarking, who actually thought that would be a good idea? But others said the people had overreacted. The only offensive thing about this is the price, somebody said. I suppose balaclavas are all racist now too, was one typical remark. So what it is a fairly tight-fitting black wool sweater, with a what I would have called a dickie, which would be a piece around the neck, but this goes up to the bottom of the nose, almost like a balaclava, but without the part that would cover the forehead and the upper cheeks, and there was a gap in there for the mouth. Now it's not even blackface. All it is a sweater that for some ungodly reason covers the lower part of the face. Anyway, well you know, the culture of apology and incredibly destructive. Anyways, I don't hold a brief one way or the other for Gucci. I'm not crying any crocodile tears for the European fashion company, but one more victim of political correctness. I'm always have my antennae up when a paper like the Globe and Mail lauds a politician as one of the best we ever had. Canada needs more leaders like Joe Clark. Now, Joe Clark, at quite a young age, at 38, I think, became the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party, and he went on to become Prime Minister for a very short span, about 9 months, from 1979 to 1980. And he headed a minority government, and it took him less than a year to be voted out of office by Parliament. And some say because he simply couldn't count. There was a controversial budget that was being put through, which would include a 16-cent a gallon, a 16-cent a gallon surcharge on gasoline. The budget was defeated. There were a number of parties in the House of Commons. The Conservatives had the most. Then came the Liberals close by, the Socialist New Democratic Party, and the Social Credit Party. In the lead up to the vote, Clark simply couldn't count. He didn't have the votes, which would suggest under our system, the prudent idea would be to either amend the budget or withdraw it if you don't have the votes to pass it. That is, unless you want to be defeated. And that's, anyway. So Clark was in only briefly. 3 years later, he was replaced as leader of the Conservative Party by Brian Mulroney. And when Mulroney went on to win in 1984, and he would serve two terms as Prime Minister, he brought Joe Clark, his defeated rival, in as Foreign Minister, and Clark was a disaster. Anyway, he should be... we need more leaders like him, according to Paul Deegan. Well, why is that? Well, here's part of the reason. Perhaps most importantly, his government settled some 50,000 refugees from Vietnam and Cambodia, allowing houses of worship and others to sponsor refugees. This policy stands as in contrast to Canada's shameful barring of Jewish refugees from Europe before, during, and after the Second World War. They were not barred after the Second World War. That's Paul Deegan's on crack. It also changed attitudes in Canada and ultimately paved the way for Justin Trudeau's government's welcoming tens of thousands of Syrian refugees. Yes, that's quite right. Joe Clark, an idiot of the first order, facilitated the settling in Canada of over 50,000 people from Vietnam. Many of those who would go on for a generation not do well in Canada, incidentally. I was just beginning my political career back then, and I echoed a statement made by the former moderator of the United Church of Canada. Now, you've got to understand that the United Church is a pretty left-wing party, church. And it was there's a former moderator of the church, Reverend House, who said that there should be an Asian solution to an Asian problem. And he said there were uninhabited, and this is where I got into trouble, deserted islands, but uninhabited islands in the South China Seas, off the coast of the Philippines, for instance, where these people could be settled and could be supported initially by food and some infrastructure and so on to allow them to be settled. This would be an Asian solution to an Asian problem. Instead, at great expense, we brought them to Canada. A considerably foreign element. Now, Clark has gotten a lot of credit for that. He should get nothing but the moral raspberries. Now, I'll tell you, and this is a bit of a side story, how I got into trouble over this. I was, at that point, an official with the Progressive Conservative Party. I was an official in an organization called PC Metro, that's Progressive Conservative Metro Toronto, an umbrella organization. Anyway, I gave an interview to the Globe and Mail, and in that interview, I said that Clark was making a big mistake and that these people should be settled on these uninhabited islands, and I referenced Reverend House. So it's not just Paul Fromm who was saying that. Well, the way it got reported in our lamestream paper, and this is, of course, is very important to know, for me to realize, and I began to see even back then, what we have are essentially fake news papers. But I wanted these people sent to desert islands. But there's a big difference between deserted or uninhabited, in other words, there's space for them, and desert islands. And of course, what some people took from that, and particularly critics, was, oh, the hard-hearted, the monster. He wants these poor people shipped to islands where there are no resources at all. They're desert islands. You know, they'll starve to death. They'll die of thirst or whatever. Anyway, it was something of a one-day wonder. But back to the paean of praise to Mr. Clark. So after Clark, Trudeau, after Joe Clark was defeated and lost his party's leadership, and Brian Mulroney got the leadership and became prime minister. In a classy move, says this article, Mulroney, a man who is both generous in spirit and astute, named Clark as his Secretary of State for External Affairs, or Foreign Minister. It was in the government of his two-time rival that Clark flourished and cemented his reputation as an esteemed global statesman. He pushed for the appointment of Stephen Lewis, who was a socialist, as Canada's ambassador to the United Nations. He was the first G7 foreign minister to take a leadership role in responding to the Ethiopian famine. He stood up, hang on for a second, the Ethiopian famine. Yes, that was another thing that Canada got involved in, massive foreign aid. And with the result, and you know, you have to be realistic here, with the result that Ethiopia continued to be a basket case. It was not going through a famine then the sole result of bad weather conditions. There had been repeated famines, and there would continue to be famines after the famine of the early 1980s. Why? Well, because of a socialist government there that was abusing its own resources. You know, I pointed out at the time, and many other people noted the truth of what I was saying, that there would be the pictures, the pathetic pictures of children with the tears and tear in their eyes and flies around their eye, the sort of thing that there was a real tearjerker, and they're in the arms of parents, and you have to ask, if there's not enough food here, for whatever reason, why are you continuing to have children? Not to be unkind about it, but that's a valid question. Well, it turns out that in their culture, the parents very often continue to eat quite well. But the parents, would eat maybe not very well, but would eat. It'd be the children who would be on the bottom of the distribution chain who might be starving. Well, that's something that's worth noting, I think. They're a different culture. Joe Clark made quite a name for himself in liberal circles. For that. Well, what else did he do? According to this article, and most importantly, he took a very strong principled and moral stand against the oppressive apartheid regime in South Africa. That is quite true. Well, not that it was oppressive, but that he and Mulroney took quite a strong stand. Mulroney, Clark, and Lewis, the socialist, were an incredibly formidable and effective troika when it came to convincing a reluctant world that change was not only necessary, but it could no longer wait. Canada stood against apartheid and for economic sanctions against South Africa. That was true. Our position was in direct odds with our allies, the Americans under Ronald Reagan and the British under Margaret Thatcher. With Clark and Lewis's skillful diplomacy and Mulroney's sheer force of personality and persuasion, Canada pushed for change at the G7 and the Commonwealth, and the UN was relentless and resolute. The three men were on the right side of history, and there's no better illustration of a middle power standing tall and using the influence it had. A few years ago, I received a note from Clark, I will continue perhaps with that later, but who's now a big pal of the man who sold out his own country, former President F.W. de Klerk of South Africa, who was the one who
turned over his country to the Nelson Mandela and the Communist African National Congress. And the two men are now close friends in an outfit called Global Leadership Foundation. And they provide advice to heads of government, etc., etc. Okay, so one of the big achievements with, in quotation marks, of Joe Clark was his bitter opposition to the government of South Africa, or the so-called system of apartheid. We didn't have too much trouble, of course, with communist regimes, but we did have trouble with fellow whites. Now, he was not the only one, but he played a major role in rallying opposition to South Africa, sanctions against South Africa, which eventually led to the loss of power by the whites. Every murdered South African farmer today, a portion of the responsibility for that rests with men like Joe Clark and Brian Mulroney. They betrayed our people. They are race traitors. They betrayed our people. They turned power over to the communist terrorists. Now, of course, each murder is the responsibility of the villain that commits the act. I agree. Joe Clark doesn't personally murder farmers in South Africa. But he ushered in a system. He helped overthrow or undermine a system in South Africa that worked. He meddled. You know, he was the equivalent of a present-day social justice warrior. And far from praising him or saying what the article says, we need more leaders like him. No, these are precisely the sort of leaders we do not need. Not now, never again. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio. Going to take my musical break right now. And this is Amber Digby, and You're Still on My Mind.
My last drink of wine.
Wilbur Digby. Here's a song, an old Ray Price song by another blonde country and western singer, Heather Miles, Crazy Arms. With Heather Miles and, in this case, Justin Trevino, this time, I know we're going to make it.
This time, I know we're going to make it. We survived the stormy weather.
Conclude with a song here by Lacey J. Dalton. I think it's kind of a religious song. Turn to the One. Paul Fromm, and you're on the funny side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. The show is repeated today in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the funny side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. He boast our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot, and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours, which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen, and heaven bless the maple leaf forever.